The Athletic.
It's Straight Outta Cobham, a show all about Chelsea FC from The Athletic. On this episode, frustration against Burnley as missed chances mean missed opportunity to go 5 points clear. Hudson-Odoi skips England duty. It's a big week for Chelsea women as the Champions League returns. And we round up the rest of the Blues news. Available for free wherever you get your podcasts and ad-free on The Athletic, this is Straight Outta Cobham. Monday in various ways then, listener. Chelsea left lamenting missed opportunities on Saturday, but hey, it's not so bad being top of the league ahead of the final international break of the year, is it? Also, thanks West Ham. Later, Flo Lloyd-Hughes will join us to talk CFCW, but for now, please welcome The Athletic's Dominic Fifield.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Tom. And Sam Parkin's back with us too. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Matt.
Let's get rolling with Saturday's draw then.
I liked how we played today, like the intensity, the quality, the commitment from the whole group. We had big chances to win this game by 2-3 goals. This can happen in football. We don't want it to happen, but it can happen. When it happens, it's very disappointing, of course, because we are all very competitive. But there's no other way than accepting it and pick the positive. There's a lot of positive to take.
Chelsea 1, Burnley 1 at Stamford Bridge. The Blues had 70% possession and 25 shots at goal, but only Kai Havertz's first half header went in, and that meant that sub Mate Vidra was able to pinch a point for the visitors late on. Sam, on Thursday, I asked if you were concerned that Chelsea had so much possession and so many shots against Malmo, but only scored one goal. We said then it didn't really matter. This was a bit of a roosterthon for you and Thomas Tuchel then.
Yeah, maybe. I still wouldn't be overly concerned. That said, wouldn't it have been nice to have maybe Tammy Abraham at the club, or dare I say it, Batshuayi or someone like that to come in for this game? But I felt that the system worked really well in the first half. I think that the avenue for Chelsea to get opportunities was always going to be the two wide players. And I felt that having a narrow front three, you know, those kind of elusive players in Barkley and Havertz who float about and don't play up against the centre halves, I thought it worked pretty well. And, you know, if it wasn't for some good goalkeeping and some wayward finishing in the first half, particularly from the defenders with those headers, thought Christensen and Rudiger probably should have scored. You know, a 2-0 cushion at half time against Burnley, there would only have been one outcome. So, yes, you could say they missed Lukaku, clearly, probably would have been a different outcome. But I just felt that it was chances that went begging. On another day, you win that game 3-0 or 4-0.
Dom, in your post-match piece for The Athletic, you quote Thomas Tuchel saying he was super happy with the performance, if not the result. And the metrics that you listed in the piece kind of bear that out as well, don't they? It was just one of those days, you could call it.
Yeah, he had been handed the data immediately after the game. I can only assume that came in from one of his video analysts on site, because he said that he had evidence, he had proof that the performance was actually one of the better displays of the season, certainly in an attacking sense. And yeah, the data did back it up. I mean, 54 touches, I think it was, in the opposition box, which is considerably more than they've managed in any other Premier League game this season. The previous best was 40. Then you chuck in the shots, 25. That was the most they'd had. A lot of those were blocked, but yeah, that's the most they've had in a Premier League match as well. I suppose, yeah, you can argue, and a lot of people did, and Sam's touched upon it there, that throw Lukaku into that team and surely he sticks one of those away, because what they lacked was, if anything, was a natural finisher. You might also counter that by wondering whether they would have created quite as many chances had Lukaku been in that front line. I thought that the fact that it was so fluent and fluid in that front three, and with Barkley sort of in that number 10 position as well, it contributed to the number of opportunities that they gleaned and the number of times they actually got into the Burnley box. I don't know whether... I mean, Lukaku's been a bit static. That's been the argument with a lot of people. He's not been quite as on the same wavelength as a lot of the other attacking players so far to date. That will come in time. But look, I'm sure he would have put one of them away, and that would have been the two goal cushion that Chelsea required. But yeah, he was happy, and he can see a bigger picture. And I think a sense of perspective is actually quite useful at this stage. Yes, you can be frustrated that you haven't won a game that you should have won, but you know, arguably they shouldn't have won at Brentford at the start of this 7-match sequence between international windows, and he even acknowledged that. You know, that they were lucky to get a clean sheet, thanks largely to Mendy's brilliance that afternoon. And on this occasion, Burnley roused themselves to convert one of the few opportunities they did actually have in the course of the game. You know, the draw looks a lot better in the wake of West Ham's victory over Liverpool, has to be said.
Shame for Ross Barkley, Sam, that he skied that opportunity with his last kick of the game, because he was pretty impressive other than that on his first league start since the end of 2019-20 for Chelsea.
Yeah, I thought the position suited him down to the ground, really. And he had a couple of poor first touches at the start of the game where he gave the ball away. But I thought as the first half wore on, he was excellent. Had that one brilliant curling effort with his right foot. And yeah, just disappointing for him that he didn't take that opportunity. I have to put that down to fatigue, because I think it was Hudson-Odoi rolled it perfectly along the deck to him. It didn't skip up or anything, and he made a complete hash of it. So it would have been, you know, tremendous for him to get a goal. And I think him and Ruben Loftus-Cheek, I'd put them in the same category, deserve enormous credit for obviously training every day at a good tempo, trying to get themselves in the matchday squad when it looked like both of them were surplus to requirements. So, no, I thought there was some really good signs from him. And, yeah, I liked the position. I felt when Chelsea had to defend in the first half, the areas where Havertz and Barkley were positioning themselves in particular meant that on the counter-attack, because you're playing against Burnley, who, when they do get well set defensively, they're difficult to break down. But I felt when Chelsea did break in the first half, you know, those two were imperative in that. And yeah, he can be really pleased. And, you know, obviously on another day, he would have had a goal.
I know Simon's written about this for a piece for The Athletic that's going out earlier this week. But I was going to ask Sam, if you're Chelsea, you're high up in the hierarchy at Chelsea, and a bid comes in for Ross Barkley in January from, say, let's pluck a club out the air, Newcastle, do you accept it?
Oh, I think there's probably people in front of him, isn't there? There's probably enough cover there, so you'd have to consider it if it was a good offer. That said, if he's given one or two more opportunities and the level of his performance is as good as it was on Saturday with a goal and an assist thrown into the mix, maybe goals and assists, then they've got a huge decision to make. But I think when everyone's fit, you know, Pulisic, Ziyech, Werner, when he comes back in, obviously they're slightly different players that can play, you know, different roles. But I think he's probably still far enough down the pecking order for them to consider, you know, recouping some of that money for him. So that would be my answer. But I think today, yeah, I think on reflection to what has been a difficult first few months of the season for him, he should be really pleased.
Yeah, January might be a good time to get some money for him too. He's out of contract in June 2023. Dom, some concerning quotes from Thomas Tuchel regarding Christian Pulisic post-match. Back, but not pain-free, if injury-free, supposedly.
Yeah, so this is stemming from the ankle injury that he sustained with the United States team, I think against Honduras in September. And that's obviously kept him out, the ankle problem, until the Malmo game, doesn't it, when he played 16 minutes as a substitute. Came on for the last 5 minutes. It probably would have been about 15 minutes on the pitch on Saturday, but Chelsea just couldn't get him on the pitch, and Burnley equalised in the period that he was waiting to come on. He didn't really have much of an impact when he did come on either. He looked understandably ring rusty. But yeah, so Tuchel spoke about him post-match and yeah, admitted that he's still in pain. He's still suffering discomfort from that ankle problem. And he is going off now for international duty. He's been picked by Greg Berhalter and the US team for critical World Cup qualifiers against Mexico and Jamaica. And on the one hand, Tuchel's looking at it thinking, well, a bit of game time in his legs might do him some good, in the same way it might do N'Golo Conte some good as well. But he wants him to be used responsibly. He wants to ensure that the emotion of a massive game against Mexico, and we shouldn't underestimate how big that is, that doesn't sort of influence him into playing maybe more than he should. He's clearly at a certain stage in his recovery from that ankle injury and building up his match fitness that maybe, you know, playing two qualifying fixtures within a few days of each other might be pushing it a bit too far for a player who's, you know, whose body clearly has been suffering of late. So I think that there is a wariness to it. And Tuchel admitted he was frightened. He's frightened of what might happen on this international break with some of his players who aren't maybe in the best state of fitness, and what might happen to them over the course of the next fortnight. He wants to see them used responsibly so that they come back and hit the ground running when they're back at Chelsea.
So Pulisic's off on international duty, Sam. Callum Hudson-Odoi is not. Turned 21 over the weekend, and for the second time this season, he's turned down a call to the England under-21 squad so he can focus on Chelsea. What do you make of that?
I haven't got too much of a problem with it, to be honest. I think, you know, there's been situations in the past where players have wanted a extended summer break or something like that and have not answered the call to their country. I don't think you can question his attitude here because he's wanting to focus on his club and become a regular there. And then I'm sure things will work itself out on the international stage. And on the face of it, there's five or six players in front of him right now. And when you look at the type of games that England have got as well this week, you know, a great opportunity to get into that squad and produce and maybe get a goal. So for him to not be included in the first team group, I understand it. It's two or three years since his bow for the first team. Difficult, I would say, mentally to get your head around going back into the 21s, yes. But if his focus is on Chelsea and impressing Thomas Tuchel, I've not got an issue with it at all. I think it's different if he says he doesn't want to play for the senior side, of course, because he's fifth, sixth in line, but he's not saying that. So I think you have to look at every situation on his merit, and we have to, you know, back, you know, whatever him and his representatives are saying right now.
Yeah, last played for the England senior team in November 2019. Difficult to tell, really, Dom, with Gareth Southgate, but I wonder if he's more likely to get back in the England senior team by playing well for Chelsea's first team than he is for the England under-21s.
See, that would be my instinct. That tends to be how it appears to work, but that Southgate was quoted directly from the squad announcement day saying that playing in the 21s would have given them an opportunity to see him firsthand and sort of have him within the building. I mean, I don't know whether they are all going to be based up at St George's Park over the course of these 2 weeks. But he implied that it would have been more useful for Hudson-Odoi's senior aspirations if he made himself available for the 21s. I'm with Sam on this one, to be honest. I think it must be very difficult for Callum Hudson-Odoi to accept that he's still considered to be a 21s player when he's represented the seniors, I think, three times. I was a bit confused by some of the suggestions out there that he might be being courted by Ghana, because I'm pretty sure those caps were competitive, that he's basically pinned his allegiance to England now. But yeah, I mean, it's an awkward situation, but you know, if the seniors have fully fit options, and generally speaking, they do. I mean, that he's resting some players who are ahead of Hudson-Odoi in the pecking order, effectively for the senior team. So it just doesn't ring comfortable with me, to be honest. In terms of calling Hudson-Odoi out on it, but I think it's an acceptance now, and it have to be an acceptance within Hudson-Odoi that he is so far down that pecking order now. I mean, by not going up to the under-21s, he's effectively ensuring that he will remain 6th, 7th, 8th choice, whatever, and it would take something fairly freakish in terms of injuries and suspensions ahead of him for him ever to get a look in the senior setup now.
I'm glad you made that point about Ghana. And yeah, I've just double-checked it. His three appearances for England all came in qualifiers for the Euros, so he can't switch now, can he? They're competitive internationals. Sam, you and I were in the commentary box together up at the top of the East Stand, and the purring that you were doing over Reece James was clear for anybody who was tuning in.
Yeah, I don't think I probably articulated it very well. But it was almost like a professional player coming back and joining in with his mates on a Sunday at one stage in the second half, which when you consider he's playing with some of the best players currently in the world, is astonishing. I thought he was Chelsea's biggest threat going forward. There was that period in the second half where it was kind of Roy the Rover stuff. Every second ball he seemed to be winning, and then, you know, conjuring an opportunity by bombing down the right-hand side. I thought it was an exceptional performance. The numbers kind of back it up. Most touches, you know, most deliveries into the box, most key passes. I thought he was sensational. And, you know, thinking back to when we first saw him, Matt, 15, 16 years of age or whatever, I think the concern with him was probably his athleticism. I don't see that being an issue now. I think he's an outstanding defender. It's probably complacency, the one thing that would hold him back if, you know, he just dwells on the ball too much or tries too many intricate passes from a defensive position. But, I mean, he is at an incredible level right now. And, you know, you talk about the battle for the right-back position with England or the right wing-back. I mean, the only thing stopping him surpassing where Trent Alexander has been is probably the amount of goals and assists. And if he can conjure that this season, there's no doubt in my mind that he's probably a superior player already, given what he can do defensively. I thought it was a masterclass, best player on the pitch by some distance.
I know this is another brazen plug for something that we did last week, but one of our data analysts, Mark Carey, did a fascinating look at the numbers behind Chilwell and James towards the end of last week, which is on the site now. One thing that looked at, I mean, this is probably me showing my age and my lack of tactical nous, but when I think of wingbacks, I think of effectively wingers who are supplementing as fullbacks when they're defending, but they're pinned to the touchline. Where actually Chilwell and James are doing a lot of their damage, inflicting a lot of the damage on the opposition in the what they call the half space, in that sort of inner channel just inside between the sort of, I don't know, the 6 yard box and the 18 yard box, up and down the pitch. And it's almost the wide players in front of them are pulling wide sometimes, and that the combinations that they're coming up with, a lot of the wounding of opponents is being inflicted in that area. And that's why James and Chilwell are finding themselves in so many good scoring areas, let's say. I think is it 4 goals for James and 3 for Chilwell so far, which is pretty phenomenal when you think about it. I mean, that's, I think going into that game, I think it's now 8 goals contributed by wingbacks this season, because Marcus Alonso scored the free kick against Palace in the first game of the season, out of 27 scored in the Premier League, which is pretty incredible, and really reflects the attacking onus that's placed upon those wingbacks in Tuchel's system.
And I can't highlight enough how much I would have enjoyed playing with him. I mean, the deliveries that he puts in, the ball for Havertz is just incredible. And it was interesting because it's quite basic analysis, but Charlie Taylor had just about done enough to that point in the game at stopping Reece James from getting a shot away or getting the deliveries from those positions. He had to check out quite a lot. And it was the first time they were a little bit laboured getting to him. And having watched it back today, I think Ben Mee made the point when the ball ended up in the net. You cannot allow him to put that in because it's a goal. I mean, Havertz just had to get his head on the ball and it's going to flash past the goalkeeper. So it was the first time Burnley had switched off and Reece James produces that. But it's indefendable and it must be a dream to play alongside.
Yep, he was outstanding. Right, that was Burnley then. Tough run of games coming up after the break for Chelsea. Leicester away in the Premier League, then Brentford in the League Cup quarterfinal before Juventus in that big Champions League game. It does get easier after that, though, with Manchester United coming to Stamford Bridge. Well, the weekend wasn't a total bust Chelsea-wise. The women's team got a win. We'll talk about that next.
Eriksen into G. Well, that's a brilliant ball. There's no flag here on Jesse Fleming, who's tapped it away. And just her second WSL goal, and didn't she take it well? Midway through the first half, Chelsea have the lead from an unusual source. Great ball.
On Saturday, Emma Hayes' team got the better of Aston Villa, a 1-0 win at the Bank Stadium in Walsall. Jessie Fleming got the goal, maintaining her excellent start to the season and giving Chelsea a fourth win a row in all competitions. Flo Lloyd-Hughes is here to tell us more about what's been happening with Chelsea's women's team of late. It was an important win, that, Flo, given that Arsenal are flying. The gap's still 3 points at the top of the table, but Arsenal got a pretty significant goal difference advantage. So maybe Chelsea a little bit rueful that they didn't take more of the many, many chances that they made against Villa?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's two ways to look at it, really. I think the Chelsea side of maybe 2-3 seasons ago could have ended a game like that in 0-0. But with the attacking talent they have now, they've really got to put more past those sorts of teams, especially with the number of chances they have. And when you look at how Arsenal played against Aston Villa, where they were similarly frustrated but came away with a 4-0 win, that is going to be the difference at the end of the season. And Chelsea need to find those moments a little bit more. I still think, you kind of touched on the intro, to see Jessie Fleming playing like she is brilliant, and her getting more starting opportunities, because she's kind of been a bit of a sort of rotation squad player since she arrived. But I think this season is going to be a bit of her breakthrough. She's already got her first goal for Chelsea and then added another one at the weekend. Somehow got a Ballon d'Or nomination just for kind of sticking away a few penalties, but, you know, that's kind of the strange side of women's football at the moment. But she's looking great. And I think we're still yet to really see the best of Kirby and Kerr this season. Pernilla Harder's been brilliant, but she's struggled picking up an injury in the international break. Lauren James now finally breaking through as well. So, I mean, it's all in reality going to come down to that return game against Arsenal, at King's Meadow, where it's kind of the title decider, to be honest. So that and the FA Cup final on the 5th of December, two brilliant games.
We'll get to the Champions League shortly, but the next league game is at Man City on Sunday. For anybody who's not been following the WSL as closely this season, tell us why that's not as terror-inspiring a fixture as it maybe would have been in the past.
Yeah, it's a bit disappointing, actually, because next weekend is Women's Football Weekend, which, a bit like non-league weekend, is something the FA's created to kind of bring a lot of eyes on women's football during men's international break. They've been doing it for a number of years now. I think it's probably like the third or fourth time they've done it. And actually, when you look at the fixture lists, maybe a year ago, I guess, that City-Chelsea game would have been like the marquee match of Women's Football Weekend. But actually, now you just don't really see City being able to compete with Chelsea at all this season, and probably maybe for a couple of years coming up. They've got such bad injury issues, kind of half their squad's wiped out. Wouldn't say Gareth Taylor's doing a phenomenal job either with what he's got. They got smashed by Chelsea in the last season's FA Cup semi-final last weekend, and City have really struggled, and they've already lost to Chelsea once this season. So I think it's going to be a pretty one-sided affair. I think they're going to struggle to compete in that game, and I think it should be a pretty easy win for Emma Hayes. And yeah, it's just frustrating, because I think all in all, when you look at that weekend, Spurs are playing Arsenal, which, yes, is a North London derby, but Spurs have never managed to beat Arsenal, and that will probably be a pretty big win as well. And then there aren't a lot of other interesting fixtures across the weekend. So yeah, it's a shame, really, because you need sort of that one big game to really hook people in what is kind of meant to be a kind of a dazzling weekend of women's football.
Back in Champions League action on Tuesday, then heading to Switzerland to take on Servette. Currently level on 4 points at the top of Group 8 with Wolfsburg, but an inferior goal difference. Can't say I know loads about Servette, but this feels like a good opportunity to cut that gap, given they've lost 3-0 and 5-0 in their two games so far.
Yeah, definitely. I think Emma Hayes will just be seeing this as a way to rack up the goal difference. Seeing as Wolfsburg managed to put five past them, I think she'll be looking forward to this. And I think Chelsea struggled in their opening Champions League group games. They got that point against Wolfsburg, made some really bad mistakes, but managed to claim a point right at the death, and then pushed through against Juventus in a game that I think lots of people were surprised was going to be as tough as it was for Chelsea. So this is a really good opportunity to sort of just build some confidence, just smash in loads of goals, and then think about those return legs against Wolfsburg and Juve. They're going to get out of the group. It's just where they're going to finish, really. And I think they just still need to build confidence. Their defence still looks shaky. And when it is put under pressure, you really do see those weaknesses. Whereas because of the way the WSL is at the moment, there's not going to be many games where Chelsea are going to be put under pressure. So you don't really see those moments. But even in that semi-final last weekend against City, actually when City did apply a little bit of pressure, you saw pockets of where Chelsea might get kind of rattled or come undone. And I think with so many important games on the horizon, those group games, Champions League, that FA Cup final against Arsenal, they need to still build that confidence, bring in some new players. Anik Nguyen started again against Villa at the weekend. And if she's going to be perhaps now a starter in that back three, they're going to need more time with her. So this is a perfect opportunity just to build lots of confidence.
Yeah, Nguyen came off at half-time on Saturday, didn't she? But Emma Hayes saying that was a precaution. Also hoping to have Pernille Harder back for that. I just wonder, though, might it be worth, given that Chelsea are probably going to win this game anyway, giving Harder the chance to rest up a bit and not make the trip and save her for City instead?
Yeah, I mean, Emma Hayes is so mysterious with the fitness of players. And there's been a lot of sort of like mind game sub or mind game bench appearances. So Maren Mjelde, who's still recovering from a long-term injury she picked up in the Conti Cup final in February of this year. It wasn't an ACL, but it was like a bad knee injury. She appeared on the bench at Wolfsburg, essentially with no intention of coming on, but it was a sort of just like a mind games, like, here she is, she might come on, and a confidence boost for her. And she took part in the warm-up. And so she's obviously close, but she's still yet to appear this season. Lauren James against City too. It was a sort of, oh, she was never going to play. We just asked if she wanted to come along for the trip. And then with Harder as well, I think in the build-up to the game at the weekend, she sort of said that, or build-up to the City game, sorry, I think she said that she might be fit enough to play. So I think Hayes loves to have a lot of mystery around who's going to play and who's fit. But I do think, yeah, given what Chelsea have in their squad and the team they're facing, it might be smarter to give Harder a bit more of a rest with a busy December ahead.
And before we let you go, Champions League-wise, how's the group stage been received thus far? And it's the first time that it's happened. And other than Barcelona, who stood out over the first couple of rounds of fixtures?
Yeah, I think all in all, it's gone down really well. I think the coverage is probably the thing that people care most about. Actually, you know, the football is great, but actually being able to watch some Champions League action is kind of a luxury. Rarely you could watch games before the quarterfinals or the semifinals unless one of the home clubs decided to stream it, of which Chelsea did a lot, but not always. You know, a lot of clubs can't afford to do that. So actually just being able to watch games is a massive plus. But I do also think, even though there's been some big score lines because the gap in Europe is still quite big, there's also been some brilliant games. I think that 3-3 against Wolfsburg probably being one of the most entertaining group games of the first couple of rounds. So I think it's just exciting to see the best teams in Europe play each other, because you don't get to see that a lot really until the knockout games. And then it's kind of like, oh, well, we're done now. Whereas, you know, we're just getting more good quality football, which I think is really important. I've been impressed with Wolfsburg and Juve, actually. But I think Benfica have surprised a lot of people, really kind of punching above their weight in a group, a tough group as well. So I think people are excited to see what they might be able to achieve. And then Lyon have kind of bounced back with some really big wins as well. A lot of people thought, were they going to be able to compete again for the Champions League? But they've certainly shown that they're going to push Barcelona quite hard, I think, this season. I mean, maybe a little bit disappointed in how Arsenal played against Barcelona, but looking forward to that return fixture, which is going to be the Emirates as well. So I think it's all building up to being a really exciting next stage. It's predictable. Like, you could look at all the groups and say, well, these are probably the two teams that are going to progress, because there's quite obviously two better teams in each group. But at the same time, you're getting to see those good sides play each other more, which is only a benefit.
Flo, pleasure as always. Many thanks. We'll speak to you soon.
See you later, guys.
Remember, you can watch all of the Women's Champions League games absolutely free via DAZN's YouTube channel. Will that plug convince them to give me some games? No. We'll react to Servette versus Chelsea on Thursday's pod. Elsewhere in Chelsea news, mixed fortunes for the academy sides in the Dom derbies this weekend. The under-23s went down 2-1 against Crystal Palace at King's Meadow. Lewis Baker got the Chelsea goal. Former Blue Jezurin Raksaki, whose younger brother Sam is on Chelsea's books, was amongst the Palace scorers. I note that Eberechi Eze played in that game as well, which is probably quite heartening for you, Dom.
Pretty heartened all round. I think Raksaki's going to be a real player as well, to be honest. He's got a lot of rave reviews within that Palace Academy setup.
He came off the bench, didn't he, at Stamford Bridge on the opening day?
Yes, he did. I think that was his Premier League debut, because he was on the bench a few times last season but didn't get on the pitch. He's got a bright future, a very bright future.
So his brother plays for the under-18s, the Chelsea under-18s. They came out on the right side of a 4-3 thriller against Palace. That means they sit top of the under-18 Premier League South. That after Malik Mothersill's winner in the 6th minute of stoppage time. At the under-23s, by the way, poor start to the season for them. Second bottom in PL2, and the bottom two get relegated. So they'll have to find some form post-international break. Right, we're just about done for today. Dom, we've mentioned your piece post-Burnley. What else have you got in the pipeline this week, please?
Well, I'm hoping to arrange an interview with a former Chelsea player who we mentioned on the pod a few weeks back, I'm pretty sure. Do you remember Steve Watt? I think it was in our quiz.
I
don't think either of us got it either. so I'm trying to get on. He's manager of Hythe Town now, and I'd like to ask him about what he learnt from playing under Jose Mourinho and what he's maybe transposing on the Hythe Town players from those experiences.
Shouting at people and throwing them under the bus in his post-match press conferences, possibly, if he does them at that level. On Thursday, we're going to do a mailbag special, given there's no first team action this coming weekend. So send your questions in via Twitter to me, at Matt Davis Adams. Don't make them all about transfers, please. The more original and creative, the more likely they are to be read out. Do join us for that if you can. Until then, many thanks to Flo for joining us earlier, to Sam, to Dom, and to Lucy for putting it all together, mainly to you though, listener. We'll speak to you later in the week. Until then, goodbye.
The Athletic.